A note to the listener. The following story contains some adult content and language. Welcome back to the podcast. Full disclosure before we get started, I want you to know that there's a lot of ground to cover in this episode. A lot of history. And I promise it's all necessary. Necessary because Marlene Marie Evans was a real person. Not just a body found in a parking lot. So, I hope you enjoy getting to know her as much as I did.
I already answered the detective's questions when they went through all of the things.
I'm just following up.
Following up for what?
To see if there's anything the cops may have missed.
They were pretty thorough.
Please, Gladys.
Yeah, all right. But I gotta make it brief. All I can tell you is what I know.
Brief's fine.
All right, she was a sweetheart. Bit of a neat freak. Always futzing with her hair. When she first moved in, she was a shy little brunette girl who loved I Love Lucy. She would never miss a Monday night. She got the biggest kick out of the little cartoon Lucy and Desi before every episode.
You two together a lot?
No. I mean, days she was at the doctor's office, I'm at the jewelry counter at Bullock's.
But you had to come home at some point. You telling me you didn't see your roommate?
Except for Mondays, no, not really.
Why is that?
She spent a lot of time in her room. When I asked her what she was always doing in there, she said reading plays and practicing her diction and stuff like that.
6 nights a week. Even Jane Mansfield took a night off from diction.
Look, I don't know what to tell you, buddy.
Gladys? Don't look over there. There's no one over there. What aren't you telling me, Gladys?
Nothing.
Look me in the eyes.
Nothing.
Look me in the eyes and tell me that Marlene worked part-time at a doctor's office during the day and was home every night in her room, but you never saw each other?
She didn't want her parents to know.
What?
She didn't want her parents to know.
Didn't want her parents to know what, Gladys?
She started working nights as a cocktail waitress.
Where?
Ciro's.
Ciro's?
Yeah, it's Jazz Joint up on Sunset.
Yeah, I know what Ciro's is. It's a pretty swank nightclub.
She got it in her head, well, someone got it in her head, that if she started slinging drinks, she'd have a better chance of getting discovered by some real high rollers. Her words, not mine. I mean, I told her she'd have to go to Vegas for those. I think she meant bigwigs. As if some producer was going to see this cocktail waitress as the next Marilyn Monroe and put her on the cover of Life the next day.
And around when was that?
I don't know, a few months before, maybe.
Did you ever mention any trouble there? Anyone she had any problems with?
No. But like I said, passing ships, which was fine. I was tired of hearing all that Hollywood talk all the time.
Well, you may be in the wrong town for that.
I just... part of me felt bad for her.
How do you mean?
Look, I'm not trying to degrade this poor girl, God rest her soul. I'm just pointing out, she was pretty, but nothing remarkable. And the way she went on and on about what was filming and when she was going to get a big break. Enough with the Star Is Born nonsense. I wish she would just have settled down with a nice doctor. That's real stability, not the one she worked with, obviously, but...
When was the last time you saw her?
2 days before they found her. My girlfriend Sylvia was moving back to Michigan with her fiancé Barry and stopped over to say goodbye before they hit the road. After that, I went to work, and I assumed that's where Marlene was going, because she said she was working that evening.
She said she was working?
Yeah. And the morning after that, I had the early shift, so I assumed she was still in her room when I left. Any of this helping?
Sure.
I'm not in trouble, am I? She didn't want her parents to know.
I heard you. No trouble. Thank you for your help.
Hey, how come you're not writing any of this down?
I got a photographic memory.
Well, that's it?
You're a real sweetheart, Gladys.
You're welcome.
From Vox Populi and the Los Angeles Herald, this is The Angel of Vine.
My old heart ain't gaining no ground because my angel eyes ain't here.
There's a small town in southern Idaho between the Snake River and the Albion Mountains with no noticeable connection to Hollywood. The sign on the edge of town reads, Burley, a great place to live. The population of Burley has hovered around 10,000 for many years now, but back in the 50s, it was just over half of that. Interstate 84 had yet to be built, so the highway ran right through Main Street, making Burley quite the thoroughfare for travelers needing rest. On a stretch equivalent to two city blocks, you had your choice of four restaurants: the Oregon Trail Cafe, Boyd's, Nelson's, or the Sportsman's Cafe. There was the National Hotel and Bank, the Idaho Bank and Trust right across the street, a Thriftway drugstore, a Texaco, and at the center of it all, the Burley Theater, an old vaudeville house built in 1917 and later converted to accommodate a screen and projector. It was the perfect little town. They wrapped most evenings up by 9 o'clock, 7 o'clock on Sundays. But if you had grandiose fantasies of fame and fortune or desired the kind of glamour shown on the silver screen, Burley might not keep you as entertained as it did the majority of its residents. So, as soon as Marlene Marie Knudsen was old enough, she bought a one-way bus ticket out of her bustling hometown. She headed to Hollywood, California to make her dreams come true as Marlene Marie Evans. And while you can take the girl out of Burley, when the detectives searched Marlene's apartment, what they found stuck on the mirror of her vanity was a photograph of a sea of people outside of her hometown theater. The caption read, "In celebration of Shirley Temple's birthday, circa 1936. Perhaps she dreamt that one day all those people would be standing on Main Street celebrating her.
There's only one way to keep warm: strip down to your bathing suit. That is, if you're a girl. Our first story takes us to Idaho, where 50 beautiful girls are parading for the title of Miss Flashbulb. Let's see what develops in this photographer's holiday. Here are the 10 best.
Marlene was one of the 10 finalists for Miss Flashbulb. She won a very small trophy, but hey, a trophy is a trophy, right? I've never won a trophy. And she got to keep the Catalina swimsuit she wore during the pageant. That was the only contest entry of hers that I could find, but that's certainly not because there were a shortage of them.
In Boca Raton, Florida, a bevy of beauties out for the title of Miss Bicycle of 1952, one of the snappiest titles of the century.
Later that summer, the very first Miss Universe took place in Long Beach, California. I don't know whether or not the excitement of that event played a role in her decision-making process, but the following year, Marlene headed west. I found this clip at UCLA's Film and Television Archive, but at this point, it's got to be somewhere on the internet.
Before we carry on with the program, how about some Harrington?
Why, yes, I'd love some Harrington. There really is more flavor in every spoonful.
And remember, with Father's Day just around the corner, wouldn't it be nice to surprise Dad this Sunday morning with a cup of rich, smooth Harrington instant coffee?
That was Marlene's first professional acting gig, a live sponsor ad during the Dewey Bowers Review Hour. She turns to camera during the jingle, lifts the cup to her mouth, and then with eyes and a smile as wide as the lens, she delivers her line. Sure, it's a little cheesy, but it was the 1950s, the era of aw shucks and gee whiz. And what you notice about Marlene immediately was that she wasn't the girl next door type. She was, very simply put, a girl from next door. Not plain by any stretch, but definitely more of a Marianne than a Ginger. And she was a perfect fit. This clip was dug up by the press from the vaults of Classic Pictures shortly after Marlene's death. It's her screen test for a small role in the 1955 picture, Aimless Loot and Ballyhoo.
Can you take a few steps forward for me? And without your hands in your pockets? Right there. Okay, tell us your name and height and part you're reading for.
My name is Marlene Marie Evans. I'm 5'6", and I'm reading for the role of Lady Babcock.
And where are you from, Marlene?
Burley, Idaho.
Tell me one thing you love about Burley.
Oh, there are so many things.
Just one is fine.
Okay, well, my mother, she used to take me to Nelson's. Her friend Annette was the piano player in the lounge there. We used to sit and listen to Annette play Gershwin for what seemed like hours. It's Wonderful was my mother's favorite. Was that enough?
Perfect. Whenever you're ready.
Pardon?
To start the scene?
Oh, of course. I'm so sorry. I couldn't believe his character. Oh, I couldn't believe his behavior.
Yes, dear.
I thought that it was absolutely dreadful.
Yes, dear, dreadful.
Charles, are you listening to a word I'm saying?
Hmm?
I don't understand why we make the drive out here every summer.
Great. Please tell us your name again.
Marlene Murray Evans.
Marlene didn't get the role in Ballyhoo, but she did land her first on-screen role in another of Classic's movies called Broadway Tangle. She has two lines as a department store sales girl regarding the price of a child's kaleidoscope, opposite the film's lead, Gene Hagen. Now, I'm not going to go into the entirety of Marlene's resume here. I'm simply trying to paint a picture for you. So many Hollywood hopefuls, actors and actresses, arrived every day by the busload, literally, to make their mark. To this day, they still do. But where so few actually make it, Marlene was already working. I'm not saying that from a few lines in a commercial and two speaking lines in a little-known romantic comedy, Marlene was destined for stardom, but she was working. She was doing exactly what she came to Hollywood to do, and at the very least, she had a promising future, one cut tragically short.
It's just crazy to think that she would have... that she'd be all but forgotten if not for your grandfather.
Well, we hope.
Well, yeah, hopefully. Yeah, I have a lot of listening to do.
This bottle of Blue Label was extremely generous of you.
No. Not at all. No, please. I was taught never show up anywhere empty-handed.
Thank you.
Oh, no, I didn't mean you had to open it now.
Why not?
I think it's the perfect way to mark the moment.
I'm not going to argue with you.
Thanks. So,
do you have any early memories of your father?
Good ones?
Well, they don't have to be, no.
No, I do. He used to read me Three Little Kittens. I remember that. Oh, the candy dish. So in between the club chairs, which I wasn't supposed to touch, but come on, who leaves an unattended candy dish in a house with kids?
That was my favorite thing about visiting Gigi.
See? I clearly remember the recorder.
Oh, interesting. So he didn't buy the Miniphone once he became a private investigator?
No. Oh, no. He always had it. I remember pressing the buttons and speaking into it, and then he would play it back, and I thought it was funny that my voice was coming out of it. And sometimes I'd see him talking into it, and I'd sit in one of the club chairs across the room and listen. Oh, God, those club chairs were the ugliest color. The color of puke.
Oh, they'd be worth a fortune now. Gigi was ahead of her time.
He used to record himself. He had his wingback leather chair in the corner of the front room where he'd sit when he read the paper.
These rituals of Hank's were some of my favorite moments on his tapes. As I began listening, I expected to hear this, Sam Spade, Humphrey Bogart type. Serves me right for watching too many movies. Instead, though, I found a cop who loved to read poetry.
If you're up against a bruiser and you're getting knocked about, grin. If you're feeling pretty groggy and you're licked beyond a doubt, grin.
I remember his police uniform. The squad car was a big deal. Anytime the squad car showed up, it was like Christmas. He would surprise us during his shift, and he would put me in the driver's seat and put his hat on my head and let me turn on the lights.
Don't let him see your funkin', let him know with every clout. Though your face is battered to a pulp, your blooming heart is stout. Just stand upon your pins until the beggar knocks you out and grin.
But most of what I know about him is from my mother.
Such as?
He loved being a cop. Nothing made him happier. He would have done it for free. It was all he used to talk about.
But?
But, and as happy as it would make him, she was never happy about the fact that he was a cop. Well, I shouldn't say never happy, but it clearly didn't help their marriage.
Was it the hours, the danger?
No, not the danger. Not on the job, anyway. That was the 50s. The danger was that he would have one too many with the boys after work, stay out all night, hitting on the girls in dispatch. I mean, she was a mother of two. That was enough stress on its own. And it only got worse when he started his own agency. No red tape, no partner, no set hours, no one to answer to.
About that, how much do you know about the circumstances that led to him leaving the LAPD?
I know some, but this is more her department.
I found all of the newspaper clippings he kept.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is what the papers said, and there are a couple of names to remember to understand exactly what went down. First, the Honorable Benton Francis Hughes. He was a judge in the Los Angeles Superior Court at the time Hank was on the police force. The other is Benton's son, Forrest Hughes. Forrest was attending Dartmouth, majoring in finance with a minor in Russian, probably to piss off his father. Anyway, the short of it is, Forrest was home for a break during the summer of 55. Hank comes across a drunken Forrest one night while he's off duty outside the King Eddie Saloon. Apparently, he beat the crap out of Forrest. Broke his jaw, fractured his eye socket for no apparent reason, right?
Bud?
Mom?
Hank's best friend Ed, a fellow cop, was with Hank that night.
And that's not in the paper.
No, it's not. They said Hank acted alone.
My mother said my father swore that he and Ed saved a girl that night.
How so?
He and Ed came out of the bar and took the alley. They heard a struggle and found this guy trying to force himself on a young woman.
But there's also no mention of a girl anywhere in the clippings. Just off-duty cop assaults judge's son.
And no Ed.
Nope.
A little background on Ed Hess. At that time, Ed was one of less than 60 black officers in the LAPD. It's no question that he faced racism, both from those he did his best to protect and serve, and also under a police chief who, at that time, made certain that any officer of color faced almost impossible odds when it came to being promoted. While he's not in the report, from the following tape, I do know that Ed was there that night. And my best guess is that if Ed was in an off-duty altercation, it would have been exponentially worse for him than for Hank.
Thank you. This is a big help. I want to know exactly who I'm dealing with here. Last thing I need is to track this guy down and find out he's a gunrunner for the mob.
No, there's nothing like that on his rap sheet. A couple B&Es, some drunken disorderly. Yeah, you guys will get along great.
Hey, you know something? You got funnier. Monty still breathing down your neck?
Hell, I wish.
How do you mean?
There's nobody around me. I got four walls, an inbox, and a filing cabinet.
Sounds like my office.
Yeah, you got windows?
Of course I have windows.
Yeah, then it's not like your office. Any luck with the girl?
Nothing. She's a ghost.
Damn. I should have stayed.
What were you gonna do? Walk a bruised white girl into a hospital?
I had my badge.
And two whiskeys.
I had no problem admitting my part in it.
It wouldn't have changed a thing.
Still a judge's kid.
Still a judge's kid. Hell, he wasn't even at the station long enough to make a damn phone call. Little shit.
You know desk duty's bad if my only time outside is spent with you.
Well, I could always use the company on a stakeout if you miss me so much, sweetheart.
No thanks, I need my pension. Damn, I'm sorry, man. I didn't mean
that. Hey, relax. I know you didn't mean nothing by it. But I'll tell you what. Give me that apology again, but this time louder for the record.
I don't understand why you can't just write shit down like the rest of us.
Careful with that. You can't write down the background noise or the way a person stutters or pauses. You can't write down how somebody sounds like a liar.
Why would I lie to you?
Not you. It's just easier for me. I can't explain it.
Yeah, because you can't write the shit.
What if I just really love the sound of your beautiful voice?
What? Man, you're stupid.
After I finished my first visit with Beth and Phyllis and returned to Los Angeles, I went to one of the Herald sources of the LAPD to see if they could find anything regarding Hank's dismissal.
What they pulled was his personnel file. As it turns out, Hank Briggs wasn't fired. Hank Briggs chose to resign from the LAPD instead of putting his future in the hands of a disciplinary committee of his peers. Had they decided to remove him from the force, and let's be honest, there was a Superior Court judge hanging over this whole thing, he would have been fired. Had that happened, Hank would have lost his ability to be a licensed private detective. So by resigning, he basically took a plea deal that allowed him to keep doing what he loved.
He had this Argus C4 camera. I never even heard of Argus before, but apparently it was affordable and had a quick learning curve. And this was his business card.
Serving Los Angeles in strict confidence.
Which he later changed to serving Hollywood in strict confidence. He kept clippings of certain cases. There's corporate embezzlement, one about an exoneration involving a witness the prosecution was hiding, drugs being dealt on a studio lot. I mean, all these cases, but he's not mentioned in any of them. Ah, yeah, but that wouldn't exactly have been serving in strict confidence, would it? Never mind, I answered my own question.
So the Briggs Detective Agency was born, and Hank Briggs wasn't a cop anymore. And because he was no longer a cop, there was an entire world of information and new methods of collecting that information now available to him, especially in some of the seedier areas of Los Angeles' underbelly, where even a reliable informant never told the police everything they knew. And let's not forget that Hank also had Ed offering him help when he was able to. It would seem that it was the best of both worlds, really. Except for one detail. Hank wasn't a cop anymore.
All right, is this, okay. This is the document, the maiden voyage of the SS Briggs. Well, may she float. There's nothing gained by whining, and you're not that kind of stuff. You're a fighter from way back, and you won't take a rebuff. Your trouble is that you don't know when you have had enough. Don't give in. If fate should down you, just get up and take another cuff. You may bank on it that there is no philosophy like bluff. And grin.
The Angel of Vine is a podcast produced by Vox Populi on behalf of the Los Angeles Herald.
Thank you for listening to The Angel of Vine. If you'd like to support us, please leave us a review and tell your friends to subscribe. The Angel of Vine is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all major podcast apps. If you can't wait for the next episode of The Angel of Vine, episodes 3 through 5 are available right now exclusively on Stitcher Premium, as well as Angel of Vine bonus episodes, extended episodes, and ad-free episodes. Go to StitcherPremium.com/Angel and use promo code ANGEL to get your first month of Stitcher Premium free. The Angel of Vine is directed by E. Ryan Martz, written by Oliver Vaquer. Story by E. Ryan Martz, Jason Zumwalt, and Oliver Vaquer. Sound design by Joel Robbie. Produced by Vox Populi in association with Forever Dog Podcast Network. This episode's performances by Joe Manganello, Constance Zimmer, Camilla Luddington, Mike Coulter, Rebecca Field, Travis Willingham, Patrick Ezel, Ali Ruddy, Tom Sibley, Cree Summer, and Oliver Vaquer. Angel Eyes is performed by Desi Dennis Dillon. Piano and arrangement by James Harper. Composed by Matt Dennis, lyrics by Earl Brent.
From downtown Los Angeles, this has been The Angel of Vine. You'll hear more from us soon.
Oh, where is my angel eyes? Excuse me.